Okay, next case for argument, United States versus Locke. Mr. Rayford.
May it please the court. At Ms. Locke's trial, seven of the government's most crucial lay witnesses, some multiple times, testified that Ms. Locke committed fraud when she provided inaccurate information on her loan application process.
Now, it seems like there was quite a bit of documentary evidence against Ms. Locke. If the admission of these statements by the lay witnesses was error, why is it not harmless error? In other words, a few incorrect numbers might be typos, might be mistakes, but the volume of error in the mortgage applications and the trail of the money strongly suggests fraud.
A couple of responses. One procedural. The government has not raised harmless error, hasn't argued at all in its briefs. And we would argue that the government, therefore, has waived any reliance on that pursuant to this court's decision in United States versus Giovanetti. Substantively, however, the error here was prejudicial, and for numerous reasons.
We raise harmless error on our own. We don't treat it as that way. We have to. I mean, if we're convinced that another trial would have to lead to the same result if the jury were rational,
we
there's no reason to order a new trial.
I believe it's more of a cursory reading of the record as opposed to what the court may engage in if the harmless error was actually raised up front. But to the substance of the question, it was there was severely prejudicial to Ms. Locke for numerous reasons. First, these witnesses were really relied on by the government to put all the evidence together. And therefore, and again, this wasn't a case where it happened once in relation to one question. This was seven witnesses, some multiple times. The testimony collectively stretched over the course of 3 days. Second, Ms. Locke's defense was her good faith. And therefore, these witnesses basically instructed the jury that you can believe everything Ms. Locke says, but you still have to convict her anyway because good faith is irrelevant. But wire fraud is a specific intent crime, and therefore it severely prejudiced Ms. Locke to have witness after witness after witness tell the jury that good faith is simply irrelevant. Again, Ms. Locke really did not dispute that a fraud occurred here. I mean, her defense was that it was someone else who committed it. Therefore, given the nature of the testimony, the fact it went to the ultimate legal issue, the one real issue that was in dispute, it wasn't harmless error. It was plain error, and it requires Ms. Locke's sentence to her conviction to be vacated. Also, the district court did not just err at sentence at trial. The district court committed other reversible errors at sentencing. First, the district court held Ms. Locke responsible for alleged conduct for which there is absolutely no evidence of in the record.
Yeah, but look, if she's admitting that the loss amount, under paragraph 70, was she not also conceding the conduct underlying that amount? I mean, I understand that she withdrew her objection because the amount of the loss exceeded $1 million, sort of, you know, whether or not the relevant conduct was included. But having conceded the higher amount, wasn't she conceding that the conduct underlying that higher amount could be attributed to her?
Absolutely not. In fact, not only does the pre-sentence report, paragraph 67, but at sentencing, Ms. Locke and the government all expressly acknowledged that Ms. Locke was disputing any responsibility for any wrongdoing at any time encapsulated in the indictment. In fact, the government used the fact that Ms. Locke refused to accept responsibility to bolster its argument that the district court should give Ms. Locke the highest sentence possible under the sentencing guidelines. So the record is clear, and at sentencing, everybody understood that Ms. Locke was saying, sure, these things may have happened. It wasn't me. Therefore, given those representations, the district court was required to at least provide some factual findings, point to something or someone in the record who could draw a connection between the conduct and Ms. Locke's and the fact that Ms. Locke was responsible for that conduct. That simply did not occur in this case. And really, the government doesn't dispute that. Their argument is they cite to a string of cases from this court, which stand for the general proposition that a sentencing court does not have to make extensive findings of fact. Well, that's absolutely true. But what this court is also crystal clear about is that the sentencing court must make some findings of fact. And it simply failed to do so here. The same error occurred when it comes to restitution. Ms. Locke is appealing approximately $1 million of her restitution award. And it's the same thing there. And I won't just keep belaboring the point. Again, there was nothing in the record that showed that Ms. Locke was, A, responsible for the underlying conduct, and even if she was, that that underlying conduct was in any way tied to the same course of dealing, plan, or scheme as the conduct for which she was convicted on. Another procedural point I probably should have mentioned first was that when it comes at least to the sentencing part, the relevant conduct, the government has asked this court to evaluate this under a clear error standard of review as opposed to what would otherwise be plain error. And this court recently held in United States versus Salem that when the government requests a less stringent standard be applied, the court will indeed apply that standard. Go back to the conviction for just a moment. That this court has held in situations, back to the harmless error, because I think that's really, I'm not sure if there's really any dispute necessarily. The government does dispute, but they compare this situation to cases where expert witnesses in giving otherwise admissible expert testimony have been allowed to compare generally documents to an objective standard. We don't have any support for the proposition that lay witnesses may testify as to a criminal legal standard which occurred here. So unless the court has any additional questions at this point, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Rayford. Ms. Hallard?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gail Hellard, and I represent the government and have represented the government with a co-counsel during the jury trial of Ms. Locke.
Can I just grab you?
Yes.
What is the factual basis for the relevant conduct finding? There was no evidence about the other counts at trial. The defendant says there was no evidence tying her to the fraud and the other counts in the PSR. I mean, where in the record is there evidence tying her to the conduct in the other counts? Even in your brief, you seem to cite the indictment rather than the trial when you are trying to connect her to the other counts. I just cannot find it.
It is true that the government proceeded on 5 counts at the trial, and we pointed out the indictment as laying out the entire crime over a two-year period. At sentencing, on page 7 of the sentencing transcript, the government put on the record that the parties had discussed prior to sentencing the unconvicted properties and that they were not fraud. That is, she was not contesting that they were fraud, or else there would be a series of mini trials that would be happening at sentencing. Ms. Locke did not controvert those facts, and we did not put on a series of mini trials at the sentencing.
But again, I say to you, there was no evidence about the other counts at trial.
Right. We,
I mean, what's going
true.
On here?
Well, we chose to proceed at trial on a discrete. The court will notice that the indictment laid out a scheme.
Can you tell
to
me
defraud.
Why she's sentenced on those counts?
She's sentenced on the counts for 10 or more victims because of the relevant conduct principles, and in restitution because the crime of wire fraud is a scheme to defraud.
Now, I don't think you're reading the restitution statute correctly because it says in the case of an offense that involves as an element a scheme, conspiracy, or pattern, etc., any person directly harmed. But what you're charging, you didn't charge an overall conspiracy embracing all the different properties. you focused on specific properties, and the specific properties had just the individual victim. It didn't have all the other victims. I don't think you have any basis for your interpretation of the restitution statute.
Yeah, where in the evidence is the record that would tie the restitution losses to the offenses of conviction? There's no waiver here. I don't see any waiver here. So there has to be something, you know, in the record that make those losses part of a scheme in the offenses of conviction. And to me, too, they all seem like a bunch of discrete offenses.
Well, the defense would have us look at this as a bunch of discrete offenses.
No. The record would have us look at it.
This case is similar in the government's view to this court's decision in Belk. In that case, there were 8 convictions, but this court held that the higher amount of restitution, $675,000, was the appropriate amount, not just the $60,600 that were the 8 counts of conviction, because the crime was a scheme to defraud.
Yes, but look, there's a difference between a scheme that embraces a whole bunch of different counts, different specific offenses, a scheme to defraud all the mortgagees in Chicago, hundreds of counts. That would be a scheme, and the offense of conviction, which would be individual counts involving individual houses, that would be part of an overall scheme. That's fine. That's what this is about. The fact that the wire fraud and mail fraud statutes use the term scheme to defraud, that's talking about the particular scheme and the particular count, right? Your scheme to defraud this mortgagee. That's not talking about a scheme that embraces a whole bunch of counts. That's what you're missing here.
Well,
there's no overall scheme, and if there's no overall scheme, you can't bring in these victims, right? Because the victims of count 1 or count 10 were not the same people who were the victims of count 1.
The court raised the issue of the larger scheme. The indictment laid out a larger scheme. The government proceeded to trial on 5 counts because that was a simple, discrete way to present evidence.
No, the scheme that embraces, that gives relief to the victims, that has to be a scheme that embraces the violation of their rights, right? Like a conspiracy. Not a bunch of isolated little things, many of which haven't been tried.
Well, that would be like Belk then. Then this court would have...
Look, just read what it says.
And
we are...
Not
reading what it says. The offense of conviction must have as an element of a scheme. And any person directly harmed by the criminal conduct in the course of the scheme, conspiracy, or pattern, right? The scheme... No conspiracy and no pattern, RICO talk, was charged here. The only scheme were individual fraudulent real estate transactions, right? That's the only scheme that was part of the of what he was convicted of, what she was convicted of.
Well, what we went to trial on were the 5 counts.
But you're just not reading the English here.
Well, the scheme to defraud to the government was the bigger scheme to defraud lenders.
You didn't charge the bigger scheme to defraud. You charged the individual frauds.
Okay, we looked at this as though we charged the bigger scheme because we charged 14 counts involving...
Why didn't you charge one count of a scheme to defraud 14 different properties?
We charged one. The first count was conspiracy, and it laid out all of the conduct that the two women had done to defraud lenders, and they had done it in these 37 counts various ways. The 5 counts we proceeded to trial on was Ms. Locke.
She wasn't convicted of conspiracy.
Yeah. Correct. But at the sentencing, the court made findings that this was a 2-year scheme, not just the 5 individual counts.
What Judge McKinney says, as I would suggest to you today, I don't think the guidelines actually take into account the number of misrepresentations upon which others relied. I don't think they take into account the length of time over the course of 2 years. and the number of wire frauds.
And I agree with that, because the court made it clear that it did not see this as a five-count discrete separate frauds. The court made clear that it didn't see this as a series of five separate transactions. The court, by its findings, saw the indictment. It had sentenced both defendants. It had presided over the trial of Locke. The indictment contained details about both women's conduct, and the court said in two different places at the sentencing, once on page 38, this offense took place over a two-year period with all the attendant dishonesty within the scheme, and again on page 41, the guidelines did not take into account the length of time over the course of 2 years and the number of separate wire frauds. So the court made it very clear that it did not see this as five separate transactions. It saw this as an overall scheme to defraud.
So why didn't you charge that?
You should have charged that. Well, I mean, it doesn't matter.
What matters is what you charged, not
what some judge, you know, thinks you charged. It's what you charged.
Sure, but the indictment charged it as count one being conspiracy, counts two through three.
But you didn't get a plea or have a conviction of conspiracy.
Correct. We did not. We chose to proceed on the five that we proceeded on for simpler and discrete trial.
I want to go somewhere else with you for a minute, because it seemed very disingenuous to me for the government to say that the lay witnesses were saying the documents were fraud rather than the defendant's intent was fraudulent. I mean, they seem to have blurred the issue together. If the jury believed those witnesses, it seems to me that would render mortgage fraud a strict liability offense. In other words, any error in a document, like a mistyped Social Security number, you know, would then be fraud. Each witness who said it was fraud had to have been stating an opinion about the intent behind the error, rather than the error itself. So that really worried me.
Well, I disagree with the characterization you just gave that it would actually comment on her intent or state of mind for them to call the documents fraudulent or misleading.
Well, what else would it be?
Well, this is just like Owens. And in Owens, the expert witness, the government said, Judge, we're going to
have this. Are these lay witnesses experts now?
No, they are
lay
witnesses.
Well, then don't give me an expert witness case.
But it's a 704.
In fact, can you cite a single case involving lay witnesses who come up and say, this is fraud? Who are they to do that?
Right. And it does look like that the government's cases were all expert witnesses, but that doesn't matter. 704 is the operative rule that governs whether a lay person or whether an expert witness gives an opinion.
Yeah, but 704 doesn't save you unless evidence is otherwise inadmissible. How can this evidence be otherwise inadmissible? I'm telling you, I don't get it.
The lenders never commented on Danilla Locke's state of mind. All
they didn't say her state of mind was fraudulent. They said this is fraud.
Just like in
Seven
Owens.
Of them come up and say, you know, this is fraud. Seven people from the neighborhood.
Yes, just like the witness in Owens. Just like that. And the expert in Owens said
expert.
These documents.
Okay,
yes.
Again, you mustn't cite to an expert. Cite me to a case involving lay witnesses who...
I do not have a case.
Because you know why? Because there isn't
did
one.
Did you ask, or did someone... Were these witnesses, these lenders, asked what they meant by fraud?
Were the lenders asked? I'm sorry. What was
what
the last...
What they meant by calling a document fraudulent?
No. I do not believe there was follow-up to any of those questions about fraud. The questions that had to do with... What had occurred in the questioning just before that was what was the effect of the misleading false information? It would have stopped the loan. Why? Because it's fraudulent, because it's misleading.
Rule 701 absolutely prohibits lay witnesses from giving this kind of testimony.
701, though, makes it permissible if 701 makes this testimony permissible because... It is their perception of how this, it's the lenders and it's their own documents and they're testifying to their...
The lender have said, you know, this is a criminal fraud?
I don't know.
Well, that's what they were saying.
You don't know?
Well,
you think you can have your witnesses say, yeah, this was a crime. Or, I mean, they committed a crime against
But the lenders were talking about the effect of the false information on their lending decision and the materiality that the government had to prove.
Yeah, and so he says, this is a fraud. It's a crime. Otherwise, you know, we need the protection of the criminal laws. Otherwise, we'd be ruined.
Right, but it's fraudulent and misleading.
Would that be appropriate testimony?
It wouldn't be improper because...
Would be appropriate testimony?
Well, that wasn't what happened here.
Of course, I know it. I'm not that stupid. I'm obviously asking you a hypothetical question. The fellow says it's a fraud, which, of course, is a crime. It has to be because, you know, banks need protection against this sort of stuff. Would that be proper testimony?
It is fraud. Seems like a legal conclusion.
Answer my question, yes or no. Is that proper testimony?
No, because that's a legal conclusion.
Well, what's fraud?
Fraudulent and misleading is the effect of them on the documents. And they don't even know Ms. Locke.
But treating the seller, what's the difference here?
Well, there's a big difference.
These people are saying it's fraud.
But they're looking at documents. It's just like Owens. They're looking at documents. And in Owens...
And someone from the neighborhood comes in and says, this is fraud.
But this isn't someone from the neighborhood.
But isn't fraud in the indictment and the instructions and so on?
I'm sorry?
Isn't the word fraud in the indictment? Scheme to defraud?
Sure.
So
and the jury is
when he says the document is a fraud, isn't he saying it's
a crime?
It's the crime that's charged against her.
They're still talking about the documents. they really are. And that's
criminals, but... Okay.
You know, but it's an important distinction. If I might end with this, is that the lenders in this case never knew Danilla Locke. There was no way they could ever talk about the who did it part of the crime. They're talking about this is the false information. Had we known the correct information, it would have stopped the loan process.
Documents indicted?
No, they're part of our trial.
I see. So Ms. Locke was indicted.
Correct. But we still had to prove who did it.
Couldn't they just have testified that these were false statements and if they had believed them, if the documents had not contained these false statements, they wouldn't have made the loan. Well, isn't that all you wanted from them?
Yes. You are proposing a different way to ask the question.
The word fraud.
Yes, you are proposing a different way to ask the question, and that can always happen at a trial, to ask the question a different way.
I'm proposing a better way.
But the way it happened here was not improper. There was no way.
It was totally improper. You will forgive me, but I can't handle this. It was totally improper.
It is. If the government...
It's like a witness getting on the stand and saying... It was a murder. Seven of them. It was a murder.
And one case that the defense cited, Park Galleries, said, testimony that a witness feels wronged or defrauded is not a legal conclusion. These are lenders talking about the effect of false information. It is not unlike Owens, where a person got up and actually said, fraudulent and misleading. And this court said, that's fine. And 704 is not expert
versus
lay witness.
Who were the judges on that case?
That I don't. I can find it, but I don't know. But
okay, thank you, Ms. Hallert. So, Mr. Rayford, do you have anything further?
I will be exceedingly brief, and I just wanted to address just one quick point. The government mentioned the Belt case, but that's a case where the government actually presented evidence at trial of what they ended up using as relevant conduct. The whole point here is that there's simply no basis, no rational basis to have held Ms. Locke responsible for this conduct. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll stop and I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not, Mr. Ray? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client. And our last case is not being argued.